Welcome back once again to Royal Grown Radio. I'm Michael Beck. Thank you so much for joining us. We want to jump back into our conversation with Tim and Taylor Blake from the Emerald Cup Runneth Over. We had too much great conversation to capture in one episode. So we had some logging noise and things to deal with that Emmanuel, our audio wizard, cleaned up for us so we can bring this amazing conversation to you where we dig back into the Northern California cannabis explosion, ETs, prehistory, aliens, psychedelics, and so much more. It was a fantastic conversation. We hope you enjoy.
I'm really proud of the fact that I've really led the way for the psychedelic integration for so much of the family, so much of these people coming up here, and now they've taken it and carried that ball and really elevated it to another level. And it's really wonderful to see where you weren't seeing sacred ceremonies and ayahuasca ceremonies 15 years ago. You weren't even the psychedelic parties we were doing here, very underground. You didn't go out and do these types of things. We did a party with Still Dream here. They do an electronic party. And that was actually an advertised electronic party. And they undercover all over, trying to buy psychedelics and come in. They couldn't get anything. We had one kid working for us, this really wonderful, jolly, large kid. And this lady kept chasing around, bugging him to give him a joint and do something. He finally threw a joint, and they were like, "Get him, nab him, he gave her a joint." And they tackled Teddy and drug him off, and then they had to let him go because it's like, what are we doing with this kid who gave her a joint, you know? And they couldn't get anything on that, but because the Still Dream people were all pros, they knew what to do.
Yeah.
And, to see that come in, and like I said, all the psychedelic parties we've had here over the years, like I was telling you earlier, my one friend has said he's been to things all over the country, all over the state, you know, Burning Man, and he said he's never seen a place that's done more psychedelics than Area 101. And the transformational experiences that happen here, the joy you see, what it does for people, like that's what we're finding out with mushrooms, you know, the anxiety, PTSD, depression, and whatnot. Our friend Lauren Gertner, who was on one of the panels, he sold Tokyo Smoke, I told you guys, Tokyo Smoke and Haiku, he sold that for $400 million. He's considered the godfather of cannabis in Canada. He's got Good Cap Wellness, I think it's called, and they're putting $25 million in that to build a sanctioned psychedelic mushroom facility, and they're going to microdose Canada and the rest of the world in 5 years. And this guy has spoken at Davos, the economic summit, 2 years in a row. So this is not like a lightweight
right
guy. And he's gotten the permission of the government to go ahead and put that in. And I'm hearing that they're about to give it the first DEA sanctioned permit to Paul Stamets to do psychedelic mushrooms in Oakland.
Amazing.
So they know that it's coming. And then there's a project called the Divinity Project at Harvard that's going to be releasing their findings that they've been doing for the last 6 years. On what they picked up from Timothy Leary. So society is realizing that that's the way to rebuild society. We've damaged it enough. All the pharmaceuticals and the opiates and the crank and the bad food,
sure,
and stuff. We got to repair.
Food.
We got to regenerate society like we have to do our land.
Well, and it's so amazing to me that it's 60 years plus from when those guys were starting their experiments at Harvard, and Ram Dass and Tim Leary,
sure,
and those guys were really digging in and starting to make the correlations between mental health, psychedelics, true shamanism, and like, you know, essentially energetic time travel, things like that. And we're just now starting to touch on those things as a society, and enough people are starting to accept that those concepts might have some merit in truth. And I really think that's a super amazing thing that the history of cannabis over the last 20 years is really bringing to psychedelics. It's like, you saw the attitude change in Northern California, right? Where people stopped quite rating. They threw the joint down. They didn't come and get you guys when you had the cup, when they could have. The one state cop didn't really come after you guys. That's the beginning of people being like, you know, this isn't so bad. And I think we're right there at that same tip of the iceberg with psychedelics.
We were right there. I was younger, in the 70s. I was in my teens. But to watch Timothy Leary, look what they did to him. They demonized him, all of them. And we were really into the psychedelic cannabis revolution. And they had formed the DEA, but they hadn't really activated it. And in the mid-80s, I was getting, you know, thousands of pounds at a time of Thai and Mexican hash brought in. I was one of the youngest people. They were bringing 100,000-pound ships off of all over the West Coast and dropping that. And a friend came to me, told the story many times, but he came to me with the first super pot I'd ever seen. It was called the Grease Magic and Chronic. That's what it was named in the mid-80s. And he said, we're going to be grown under those lights that you get out of Safeway in 2 years, and nobody's going to be getting any loads anymore. And I had several thousand pounds in my backyard. I was like, you're out of your minds. We're going to be grown under those lights in a Safeway? Did you get a Safeway? And he had to give a third of the clone, 30-year crop for six crops to get that clone. I didn't take the clone because I thought he was crazy. But I did buy all the pot because it was great. It was the best I'd ever seen. But 18 months later, I had to go buy that clone from him because they'd taken out 12 big loads. And they came in, they put the federal minimum mandatories together, and then they did the private prisons. And so they 1, 2, 3. And they also, he told me at that time, they were going to replace all the cocaine with cheap cocaine on the streets in the inner cities. And at that time, we were doing cocaine, it was $100 a gram. And I had no idea what crack was or what cheap cocaine was. And so when they switched that around, all of a sudden you got $10 grams of crack on the street. And that happened within 2 years. They'd already destroyed society, and they knew what they were doing. That was the people that run this world. They wanted nothing to do with the peaceful revolution of us. But they pruned that root back and they put us in jail. I mean, I've always said the cannabis warriors that made it through all that are going to be regarded down in history as the heroes, because they wouldn't give up. And you look at all these people that did 20 years in prison, some people are still in prison, that wouldn't stand down. And because of that, they pruned that root back, or they pruned the tree back, or the bush, but the root got bigger and bigger, and it just blew up, and look what's happened for you guys. Look what's come out.
Yeah.
It overran them. And so now they're basically giving up. That's what we're seeing now. They're surrendering.
We really are seeing that from a unique perspective, working at Royal Gold Soils right now, and kind of feeding the cannabis cultivation industry from the supply side partly. It is insane how many lights are selling everywhere, how many greenhouses are going up. We thought years ago that we'd reached max, and it is at a place now where it's just exploding and it's really entering mainstream. And for people that remember when it was as small as it was, it's overwhelming to see how much it's growing right now.
And for you guys, it is, huh?
It
COVID
is.
COVID didn't really slow you down at all.
No, quite the opposite, actually. And what's crazy, too, is that, you know, there was always been that fear in these hills and in this part of Northern California that when this happens and we get to this place where it's gotten this big, the market's just going to, you know, collapse on the other end of it, where it's just not going to be profitable. And it's going to be harder for mom and pops to survive. Right now, we're seeing the demand is still growing every day as far as the actual use on the end user, right? So I think that a lot of it is there's every day we're just turning on more and more people through the stigma being lifted on cannabis, mm-hmm. you know, where more people are using it, more states are going online, more people are not afraid to use it anymore. So yeah, it's pretty wild to see the market still growing on the cultivation end, and the supply, you know, isn't crushing the entire market. The prices aren't, you know, bottoming out like we thought they would.
Huh. Well, I think you guys will, even at that point, you'll just end up with larger accounts too. As you come online, you see some of these larger, you know, places come in Lake County and whatnot.
Sure.
I think what's going to be hard for us is it's, you know, Fish and Game and the Water Board and all the people coming after us on that side, the sequence stuff down here in Mendocino. Yep. They're just trying to push us out of the hills. It isn't going to really be the lack of demand and stuff. It's going to be our government officials and all of them just want it all in the flatland. That's what they're trying to do here in Mendocino.
Very much the same up in Humboldt. And you're seeing people apply for giant permits down in the bottoms, down in places where they're going to have to run lights and have to consume all this energy where it's foggy and things like that, because they want to bring it down closer to town for the traffic so they don't have to worry about the infrastructure out in the hills supporting these thousands and thousands of enterprising businesses. And it's really... I think you're correct. I think it is threatening those people that are further out, and it's harder for them to get their product to market. It's harder for them to get their soil to the site and to get their people out there to work.
Yeah, all of it. Yeah, Ed Rosenthal and I had almost a brawl at Deep Green, one of the cannabis conferences in the Bay Area, because he was on stage saying that we were going to be toast once it became legal, because we didn't have access to the labor and the land, and we know the usable soil, the water and whatnot. And I went back, we made up later on, because he was right in many ways. I think that we'll still have a significant community here of doing that, but obviously the pieces that aren't easy, that are steep, that didn't have water, taken from the creeks, whatever else, they're going to go away. And it is going to be a lot of large-scale farming in there that's going to come down. But it is nice to see that the small farmers, at least till now, a lot of them are still making it. And, you know, a lot of that land in the valleys and stuff, it's like Alec Dixon from SC says, it's toxic. It's going to have a hard time passing. you know, until they bring a lot of your soil, until they start cleaning all that stuff up,
sure,
remediate a lot of that. So there's a few years in there.
Yep.
I think 64, Gavin Newsom, you know, he came up to, you know, Humboldt, he came up there and promised that he'd never allow large-scale farming for 5 years. We signed 64 based upon no large-scale farming, and then two months in, he opened that up and let all the Santa Barbara and Salinas people come in. And, you know, it's a great thing for consumers and other aspects of the industry, but for the small farmers and stuff, they were promised 5 years, and that's why I signed for 64, was because we were going to be able to sunset out. And I think that was expedited in many ways by what happened.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't have any problems with Gavin getting recalled, because he lied to us. You know, I voted for him, not that I'm against that, but he lied to us and let those interests come in.
Yeah, and that's a very common gripe among everyone in the industry up here, because it really did change the entire landscape. You're like, hey, we voted for this thing, and now it's not the same thing. Like, we at least had 5 years, and a lot of people discussed it at the time that we feel that was the flaw in 64, was allowing the state legislation to have the opportunity to change anything about it without a voter referendum.
Then. Yeah, but they promised that they wouldn't. I mean, you want to believe politicians. I mean, of course, maybe that's naive, but you think that, you know, if somebody says something and they want your vote, that they're going to stand up to that. I mean, you don't think they'll do it 2 months in. Maybe they'll start arguing 3 years, maybe.
But it was so quick. It was right out of the gate.
2 months.
It really has. It's hard to feel any genuine, you know, sense of like, oh, we weren't really planning for this and it just sort of happened. It's like, no, the money was in your face and you ran with it. You took it.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, like I said, I'm still glad the 64 went through, because, you know, our family, my 90-year-old priest uncle who just recently passed away, the oldest reigning priest in the Bay Area, he felt comfortable to use CBD products, and then even THC cartridges. We've got him dancing, doing it with his cart because of 64. And my brother-in-law, who's captain of Watsonville PD, serious cancer. And they had to arrest, well, not arrest him, they had to subdue him because he was blacked out, going crazy on pharmaceuticals. And my conservative sister, his wife, finally said, go for the cannabis, and he loves it, and he's doing it every day because of 64, because of legalization. So it opened it up. It's going to make a huge consumer industry, which is blowing up for us, and we're going across the country. Once California fell, the rest of the country, you guys will do great, because you'll be moving soil all over the country and stuff. A lot of good things in there. But for the farmers, especially the ones that, some of the older people that don't want to do social media, they're not really brand people, they're not good at that. They're not the kids coming up. That's not their thing, you know. It would be nice to see them get a few more years, but life is life, you know.
Yeah. That's what the cooperative, distro model, you know, may actually, be the only saving grace for those small mom and pop farms, is to be able to kind of, you know, pull a whole mountain together of neighbor growers, you know, and kind of become a bigger force as far as coming up with some good quality flower to present to a brand, white label it with somebody else, you know, kind of stay in the game that way. And quite a bit of that.
That's what Flocana was supposed to do.
Sure.
But they didn't hold up those standards.
There's been a few of those that have attempted and haven't been able to pull it together quite yet. But yeah, there's hope, I think.
Oh, no, I think that's open. There's always an opening for somebody. So I think we've talked about that. There's going to be a real nice slot for somebody to go in there and do that, because they pulled out of that, especially when we go interstate. You know, right now, our value of up north, the Emerald Triangle brand, doesn't carry as much in LA, which is three quarters of the business, because they're not as concerned about Emerald Triangle pot. They're already doing indoor,
yeah,
and they live, for the most part, a different lifestyle. But I really believe once we get out of the state and we get into interstate and across the world, you know, the Emerald Triangle brand will carry a tremendous weight.
I agree.
And
I work in the Southern California area quite a bit. And there's a lifestyle choice that's different than we live up here. Organic food maybe just doesn't have the same weight that it has up here, or, you know, fresh air, those things. So when you're eating McDonald's, you know, you probably don't care, you know, about the quality too much,
yeah,
you know, and there's always going to be a demand for that stuff just about anywhere. I remember going down there years ago and having somebody tell me that if their cannabis didn't give them a panic attack, they wanted their money back.
And well, it's almost still there.
That's to be so bizarre.
They're looking for the highest THC, which is devoid of most of the other cannabinoids. So they're really going for that panic attack with 34% THC. The highest THC has never won the cup. I had a guy come up with 28.5 back when that was the highest.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to win the cup. And I said, I'll bet you $100 you don't, because it's never won the cup. Our judges aren't looking for that. Our judges are looking for the terpene profiles and for the overall cannabinoid and the high that comes in. But that is still the thing. But you know what? I was down in L.A., and we've been down there, and it's been pleasantly surprising to see Because I've got that Northern California prejudice, or the LA, you know, and to see how much they're embracing psychedelics, the alternative living, organic living, spirituality. We went to this place, we talked about that viewing lounge, and it looked like something you see in Santa Cruz or San Francisco.
Sure.
Crystals and singing bowls and stuff, and I was like, this is LA, this is better than anything I've seen in San Francisco or Santa Cruz. And James Shaw, who runs that, he's been up here for years, 10 years up in Arcata, and he said, you know, LA is really, really evolving.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, that was really cool.
Yeah, it's interesting because we live in Mendocino County, both of us. I live in Willetson, obviously Tim lives in Laytonville, and it's so funny because you kind of forget like how nice it is. Like we went to like Irwan and Venice Beach and we got like delicious organic to-go plates and we were like drinking like green juices and we were like, this isn't so bad, you know? But it's just because also like where we live, there's not like a ton going on. I mean, Willetson and Laytonville are not like the hubs of
Irwan's
culture.
All organic. It was the nicest... Well, supermarket, but a deli. I mean, I could have eaten there, you know, every day for 40 days and not eat the same food. I was just blown away. Have you been there?
Sure. Oh, I spend so much time down there. It's incredible.
That's amazing.
And we talk about that all the time, how, you know, 20, 25 years ago, organic food and this whole movement when it really started to erupt and, you know, health food stores were popping up along California. But if you still went to the East Coast, it was almost impossible to find organic food in a traditional market. And even the health food stores out there were pretty much just vitamin shops. But now, yeah, you go to places along the coast of L.A., and they're super, you know, hip with great restaurants. It's easy to eat vegan and organic, and it's amazing. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I eat meat. I just don't want to eat
not
clean meat.
Sure.
So for me, it's like, I'll go vegan if I'm not going to get clean meat. But to go in there and see organic lamb, I'm like, organic lamb?
Yeah.
You know, these guys, I mean, my hat's off to them. And then, you know, talking to people, realizing the Self-Realization Fellowship with Yogananda and the Theological Society. A lot of those were down there 40 or 50 years ago, but it kind of got a little sidetracked, and you know, we saw that go down. You know, you brought up Ram Dass. You know, I was in Santa Cruz. I've been meditating for almost 50 years now, and there was a little meditation group at UC Santa Cruz, and so I went up to it. You know, I think I was 17, and there was only about 8 of us, and we sat down and did a meditation together, and then a few months later, Ram Dass's book, Be Here Now, came out, and I realized that I was actually sitting down with Ian Bhagwan. They'd come back from India, and we'd actually had a little private meditation with them, and so it was really a really highlight to look back and think I got to actually do a private meditation with him back before anybody knew who he was.
That's incredible.
Amazing, yeah. Be Here Now, that book changed my reality. I actually took a meditation course when I was 18 years old, and got the Beginner's Guide to Meditation by Ram Dass, and immediately ended up with Be Here Now, and I think that really shaped who I was and really guided my psychedelic journey. And I think a lot of people out there getting exposed through those concepts to meditation, I think that's really changing things now. It's coming back and elevating again. And I love how these things kind of come in cycles. And I feel like we're at another rising point.
Yeah, it wasn't. They just trimmed it off because, like we were talking earlier, you know, you had Carlos Castaneda coming out with those books and Be Here Now, and we were lifting off, and they just didn't want it, and so they came in hard. For at one point in the early 2000s, you couldn't even get acid at the electronic parties; you could barely get it. They'd hit 4 or 5 guys and give them 20 years, and they just pruned it right back. And now there's such a proliferation; you can find good LSD anywhere. And look at the psychedelic mushrooms.
Yeah, it's a comeback for sure.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah, it's funny you guys mentioned the Be Here Now, which is obviously a really common thing when Ram Dass comes up in conversation. For me, Grist of the Mill.
Oh, yeah.
Great book. And, you know, I got turned on to that book, I think it was 1994, and I just lost my brother-in-law to HIV. And we were super close. And coming from New York City, death was something that I experienced a lot of. And that book changed my life more than Be Here Now, just because of its take on death and him eating psychedelics to go sit at his mom's bedside while she was passing. And, man, that book just blew me away.
Yeah, there were so many of them. Dan Millman, The Way of a Peaceful Warrior.
Great book. Yeah.
You know, they're just, you know, we all know these books that came out that were just like, they were guideposts for us to really follow. And what's amazing is I'm a UFO guy from childhood, but there was a book, Billy My Ears, the Palladian book, and there was a couple things going out, but they were just like little breadcrumbs, you know. Now this generation has the benefit of having these knock down the walls where we're just really learning so much, and we're being told so much, and it's all coming out. Now we're all ready for the ETs to land and take off, you know. We're ready to all go out to outer space. You know, I mean, there are some amazing things that are coming in that just blow my mind. There's technology things. We were talking with William Brown, and he's working with the Seam, Herifrim, I can't remember his name, but we were talking with them because they're doing, you know, you've got the mycelium network in the ground where they got the metamorphic field, which is the mycelium network in the universe. And their Nassim is like the modern day Einstein or Tesla. And they've got 12 patents of free energy pulling out of the metamorphic field. And they're building crystals now that take 2 years, these tetrahedron crystals, and they're tying them into water systems, and it's making 100% more efficiency in the production.
Wow.
And so they're actually pulling from that field. They're wanting to work with cannabis people to now do more research. So we've been working with them. We want to bring them in. And they're actually then taking those crystals and making them so you can wear on them and take them to the sacred ceremonies and have even more activated the sacred ceremony experiences. And of course, they're using it for free energy. So the stuff that's coming in now in the next couple of years, they're going to have activated free energy systems within 2 years. So what we're going to be looking at here in the next couple of years is really we're going to take all this and move to the next level. We're going to have the introduction to our UFO family, our ET family. We're going to have free energy. The improvement in food production is going to be such that we don't have to have starvation anymore, you know, and we're going to regenerate all this land, and we're going to heal the planet.
I think that's so right on, and I really think it ties into kind of the interdimensional travel as well. And yeah. You know, the crystal, you know, powers of crystal healing really have been a big part of cannabis for me. And it actually really blew my mind when I first heard about cannabis crystals. And I'm like, wow, it's a crystal. And, you know, I've learned a lot since then that the trichome is crystal. But it really, to me at the time, those kind of mismatched terms opened up a conceptual energy of, all right, now what does this mean when you start looking at Lemurian crystals and some of these things that people say were placed here by other beings with information coded into crystal technology and how to communicate across time and space through those things? So I'm so amazed by that kind of technological tie-in you just brought. I really want to dig in more to that with you.
Oh yeah, it's blowing my mind to see it, to see what Lauren's doing with psilocybin and microdosing the world, and see what William Brown and Nassim are doing with technology. And I look at a future that's coming at us that they've been preparing us for a long time. I was going to do a UFO television program before sightings. There was a program called Sightings in the 80s. And before that, I had spent about $150,000 developing a UFO program because I'm deep into UFOs. And I was working with John Lear, who's an ex-CIA combat pilot, 22 years, and he's the head of MUFON. He got out because of so much UFO stuff. And his dad was Bill Lear, who designed all the Lear jets. And we were working on it, and then he finally came back and said, I went and talked to a bunch of people, and like the inside people, and he said, I realized you're not like one of them. You're not been sanctioned for this. They have their own timeline and stuff. And so I said, you got three kids and stuff. I'd suggest you just go back home and just like not get yourself killed and just not do this, because you're going to watch this come out. And I did. And then a year and a half later, Sightings came out. And he said, by the early 2000s, they're going to go to work. 90% of people are ready for UFOs to come in. And they're going to be ready for us to have this public acknowledgement. And it happened just the way he said. And we're to the point now where that's why a lot of the psychedelics are coming in, because the ETs and our family throughout this universe are getting ready to do that, and they're preparing us to move up to that energy so that we can be ready for them. And that's happening very quickly.
I've been really fascinated about this recent story here with the Navy being circled by what was initially, you know, called just some mysterious drones, but some of the actual footage that they're showing now.
Well, they're releasing it on purpose.
Yeah.
You saw the Israeli general. The Israeli, the General Omri, came out and talked about UFOs and said we have bases on Mars and stuff. He came out with saying all this heavy-duty stuff.
Wow, I didn't see that.
And he didn't say that without being sanctioned.
Yeah.
Or they would have offed him. And so, yeah, it's coming out left and right now. They're just putting this out. They had the pictures of the ships that are coming out of the water in Baja and off of Hawaii. Every day now they're coming in. I went to a UFO conference when the eclipse happened a number of years back. And I was going to go to the big party in Oregon. I had friends that were producing that.
I was nearby.
I was going to be able to go into that, and because I had friends there. And then Phoebe, God bless her, said, I really want to go to this UFO conference instead. And I'm a UFO freak, so I was like, okay, but we're going to miss this great party. And so we went there, and I got to sit down with all the leading people, Lauren Eisenhower and Michael Sala and Corey Good, all of them. And I didn't have any idea who these people were. I've been following UFOs and interacting with them since I was a child, but I really thought I knew a lot, but I didn't. And so we had an intimate, you know, about 300 people got to spend 4 days together. And I was just blown away by what they were telling me. I had no clue what had happened, what really is the truth. And then everything they said came true. And then I started following all their research. And it's just mind-boggling to really see the true story of what's taking place. You guys have heard about America Before, Graham Hancock's book?
I haven't.
No, I'm not familiar.
He just finished a book, Fingerprints of the Gods, and Graham Hancock's done several books that were bestsellers, all about, you know, ancient civilizations and ETs. But the latest one is that they're proving now it's the Younger Hydrus impact theory, which is not a theory, it's a fact. But 12,865 years ago, within 5 years, a comet hit Michigan, a big one, and it also hit Greenland. They're just finding the impact under the ice now. And they're proving it, that all the little ponds up and down the East Coast were formed by these skyscraper icicles that hit there. And so there's the Clovis people. You've heard of the Clovis people, which were before the Native Americans. They've only found one skeleton of the Clovis people. So archaeologists have been, what happened to these people? I mean, how did all of them disappear? Okay, well, that comet hit and about a 200,000-foot tidal wave washed over America, took it out, just took it all out. And it also took out all the civilizations that were living along the shores of Japan, Bimini, and down there they talk about. It was basically the Lemurus and Atlantis, and all that stuff got taken out. They're finding it now offshore now with all the new technology. And the ETs that could get out got up and then came back down, but most of their civilization was ruined. And those were the Anunnaki that you see in the Sumerian text. If you go look in Sumerian text, Zachariah Sitchin wrote a book, The 12th Planet, the Nibiru, about the Anunnaki. He was a Jewish scholar, and he wanted to get into pre-Jewish history, and so he started studying in the Sumerian text. And so if you go back and look at Akhenaten and Nefertiti in the Egyptian pictures, they never had their hats off, but the kids do. And you can see the pictures, and they're elongated skulls. Okay, that's because they're Anunnaki. So what happened was those Anunnaki came and realized that they were going to have to carry on, and they needed a workforce. And so they created us. They're the ones that created us. It wasn't done by God. It was done by the Anunnaki. And that's what Zachariah Sitchin was saying years ago. Well, since then, there's all kinds of people now studying Sumerian text, and they're deciphering it. And there was basically a kingship and queenship of going back 250,000 years with like a dozen people that ran this planet. We're not the people from here. The Anunnaki were the ones that were here. They also have a home planet called Nibiru. And so they worked for cloning. Enlil and Enki in the Bible were the Anunnakis that basically created us. And they worked to clone us for 1,000 years. And they got us down to where we were not like them. If you look in the Sumerian text, you'll see giant people holding lions. If you look at the Bible, it talks about in the time of the giants. You can go back and see all this stuff. It's all right there. They covered it all.
Yeah, I remember diving into that, the Chariot of the Gods, when I was in high school.
Yeah, Chariot of the Gods.
Chariot of the Gods, man. That really just, being a recovering Catholic, which, you know.
Me too.
And that just opened my floodgates to the unknown and all these other possibilities.
It was the possibilities, but now they're being in the facts.
Sure.
They're bringing it. See, I was with you. I could dream about it. I could see it, but we didn't have it grounded. Now they're grounding it. And this is science. They're bringing in the fact. They said science is going to prove religion. So it is. Yep. And so they basically got us down. But instead of them, they're like 8 to 12 feet tall, about 600 to 800 pounds. They made us smaller so we wouldn't fuck with them. And they gave us only about 10% of their mental capacity. And they're actually, I saw a program on Gaiam that they limited our lifespan to 122 years. There's a gene, and this Russian group has now found that gene and they're taking it out.
Wow.
They live for 20 to 30,000 years. They just wanted to really keep us closed in. And then what happened was that 1,300 years later, another comet hit, and they knew this one was gonna hit. And the dad had come down, and they'd been not only making us, but they'd been making all the half-man, half-beast, all the stuff that you read about, the mythologies. Those are real, true things. And dad came down and went, this is against the prime directive. What the fuck have you guys been doing? He goes, this has got to stop. And so they knew this thing was going to hit. And so NL told Moses about it, and that was Noah's Ark. And that was the indigenous people that survived. And those Anunnaki embedded themselves into those indigenous people, which became the Peruvians, the Mayans, the Egyptians, all the Sumerians. And then they decided, dad came back because they were going to wipe us out, and they decided to let us evolve. And so that's why they let us evolve, and that's why they embedded themselves into those civilizations. And those were basically our kingships. That's why they're all interbred, because it was the blood. You know, if you look at Abraham, because they talk about Abraham living 800 years, those were all half Anunnaki. And so they basically were interbreeding to keep that blood for that lineage and that ability to live so long.
Wow,
so when you start hearing the real story, it's like, yeah. Well, now this starts making sense. Okay, now we're making sense here.
Yeah.
And so that's what really happened.
You're tying it into the Bible and stuff.
Well, it breaks right into the Bible. Well, think about the Old Testament. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and they're all fighting each other. God didn't do that shit.
Right.
Okay, that was the Anunnaki, who all had their little fiefdoms and people, and they were just pitting us against each other and doing all that crap. And then they brought, and then they decided, if you look at it, they then decided to bring in Jesus and Moses, but Buddha and Muhammad and all these different people through different religious beings to talk about, you know, okay, it's all about love and peace and forgiveness. We're going to get rid of the eye for eye and tooth for tooth thing and shit. We're going to get rid of that. And that's when the Anunnaki kind of disappeared and moved back and let us evolve. And
wow, I love it. And to me, that really ties back to a lot of every indigenous story and every religion. You look at Metatron and the Jewish religion,
all the same.
Sacred geometry all comes down to the same thing, and it's vibrational technology.
It's all right there. And these people knew it all. These people knew every bit of it, and they were way out in front of us. And you know, it's really cool. What I think the coolest thing I've gotten from all of it is that likely Enlil and Enki are still alive, and we're going to meet our creators within the next 10 years.
Wow.
We'll meet them. What they're doing is, part of their directive was to clean this mess up. That got a little sideswiped in there. There's a whole nother series of things that took place, but they're going to come down and we're going to see this. And so we're going to actually meet our creators, and we're going to be told, because they say that this planet is one of the most...
We got a tree coming down.
Yeah. They say this planet is like the most unique and most sought after and studied planet in this whole part of the universe, because every other planet knows that they're part of all the other galactic council of planets and all the other beings and stuff. We're a faith-based planet. We don't know who the hell we are. And so they come down to study us because they're like, dude, look at these people. They're clueless. And they're still doing pretty good.
Well, and there's some theories I've read also that we are actively quarantined.
We are. Oh, no, absolutely. Well, that was a quarantine because we're not very good people. I mean, overall, this nuclear stuff and all the little shit we want to do and stuff. We got to learn some lessons and get rid of this stuff. Get over that. But
we've got some conscious evolution to do before we're welcomed outside of this, essentially outside of the atmosphere and outside of our solar system.
Well, at that conference I went to, there's a gentleman named William Tompkins. William Tompkins, he was a kid and he had a genius memory. And his dad took him down to the ships before World War II in San Diego. And from memory, he rebuilt all those ships as models, even down to all the secret trick shit. And then he put it at a Macy's parade. They had it out there. And so all these Navy people were like, who the hell, what, is this a spy? Who did this shit? And they come into his house and stuff, and they interrogate him, and they realize he's just this genius 17-year-old kid. So they jumped him into the military, and he ended up becoming the head of the spies against the Germans.
Wow.
And and so he was bringing back all this stuff about them building spacecrafts and what was going on and stuff. He ended up running the whole NASA space program until 1985.
Really?
Okay, so that's who William Tompkins, very famous guy.
What's his name?
William Tompkins. If you look at William, I can give you the books. I'll get the books. Michael Sala has the best book on him. Did interviews with him before he died. Michael Sala has written a 6-part series on all the UFOs and how it all came about. And so William Tompkins sat down and told him all the stories. And so what happened was that they came back and started hearing all this stuff. Well, there's a lady, it was the Brill Society, and there was these channelers and psychics that were channeling the Andromedans, and they were being taught how to build spaceships. And Hitler had heard about this, and he came in and talked about it being really cool and co-opted the whole thing. They thought it was going to be for cool stuff, but he was thinking of some other ways to go with this. They started building them to make military and whatnot on them. So they heard about all this stuff, and that's why they demonized. If you go back and read a book called Phenomena by Annie Jacobson, it's a Pulitzer Prize winner. She goes back and shows that they knew how much psychic ability did work, and they knew all about mushrooms. They went and found the mushrooms themselves way before we did. And that's where they got remote viewing and all that stuff. They were working on creating acid because they knew all this stuff. And they demonized it because they didn't want us to get it. And she writes a whole book. It's called Phenomena.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, she's written several best-selling Pulitzer Prize winning books. That's all I do is read.
I tell you, I've always admired and loved Paul Stamets' work,
mm-hmm.
and that recent movie that he put out. What was the title of it? Do you remember the movie that we saw it at the Minor Theater?
Uh-huh. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can't. The title is completely. But what a powerful movie! You know, I took my 12-year-old son. I think he was 10 or 11 at the time, with a handful of our friends, our old Grateful Dead crew. We've all got kids around the same age, and we went in and like on a Sunday afternoon, and we pretty much just took up the entire Minor Theater for this documentary.
That's which awesome. Is the longest operating built for movies theater in the country.
Wow. Right.
Up in Arcata, operated by a really great friend of the industry, Joshua Neff. So
very cool.
People out there at home, go check out the Minor Theater when you come through Humboldt. You won't be disappointed.
Yeah, they've done a fantastic job. They're offering food and beverages. They bring them right to your chairs. It's a really spectacular way to see a movie.
I've heard about that place.
But I tell you, this movie, Paul Stamets, his work and his breakdown of mycology and what it's doing for the planet and what it's going to do for the planet, it was so powerful to walk out into, you know, the broad daylight Arcata streets at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when it was over, and all of us just in tears. It was so well done. And a lot of us talked about the feeling afterwards of just this calm. You know, there's a level of you know, being kind of somewhat depressed or upset about the things that are happening around the globe. If you're an environmentalist, you know, if you have children and you want them to have a future, there's things that happen every day that, you know, just have a way of really just digging into you, you know. And there's times, you know, where I'll go through the day feeling, you know, a little hopeless for my kids, you know. This movie just did such a fantastic job to kind of make you feel like everything's going to be okay. Like, you know, the magical world of mushrooms is really what's happening here on the planet. It's not about me, and it's not about you, and it's not about, you know, these little things that are happening. There's a bigger magical picture that's happening on this planet, and it's really what it is the magical world of mushrooms. And it's so well done. If you haven't seen it, check it out.
I've seen that, and Paul was amazing. Have you seen Kiss the Ground with John Rulex?
I haven't.
Oh, John Rulex did a documentary, Kiss the Ground, and it kind of picked up and just brought in that next level of what you can do with regenerative farming. And they show that the oldest farming region in China, it's like the oldest ancient place, they just made it into a desert by just like we did in the Midwest.
Right.
And then they went with regenerative farming practices, and they showed time lapse and everything. And over like a 5-6 year period, they turned it into an oasis.
And it's all like, the fungus coming back.
It was all of it. And to watch this though, to watch this come back and just go, I mean, I understood what mycelium can do. I understand regenerative farming, but to see that you could take a desert and hundreds of thousands of acres and then turn that into an oasis made me realize, God, we can do that in Midwest. We can do that. And they talk about it. You know, you ought to really check it out. John Rulak, it was incredible.
I grew up in the Midwest, in Michigan, right along the bottom of Lake Michigan. And I talk about this all the time, that there's an energetic vortex there as well. It is an extremely powerful place. You have people coming out of there, connecting in a different way. Derek, who's won a bunch of cups, he and I met in Michigan years and years ago. There's just this network. And it's really, really special. And the fungus that covers most of the state is still intact in the northern half of the state. Above Grand Rapids, there's a single fungal network that crosses literally the entire top of Michigan. And so you go up to Miesic, Michigan, home of the largest fungus in the world. And, you know, it was like this kind of lame tourist attraction thing to me as a child in Michigan. And the more I've learned about regenerative farming and soil food web and tapped into Elaine Ingham and Jeff Lowenfels and understand these relationships a little bit more, which there's just so much to understand. None of us can ever even really break through the bottom of this giant barrel of information. But it's so amazing to me that we're just now learning how fungus communicates over long distances instantaneously. It can take phosphorus, pull it into the fungal mass miles and miles away, and release phosphorus miles away in basically real time in exchange for plant sugars and things that the plants know to release in order to exchange and pull all of the things from the soil. So you're able to move mineral content and nutritive content all over the planet. And that's how areas that maybe not so ideal for certain plants or certain ecosystems change as the fungal body starts to move back, and you can get minerals that are over here halfway across the planet.
I'm humbled by it. It's way beyond me. I'll tell you what, the mycelium has got, I mean, it's an alien thought form that's so far beyond us. And look what it is with psilocybin. I mean, come on, I see the spores and all the dishes and everything that we're working with, and I'm just like, oh my God, you know, they're definitely intelligent, and they're guiding us, and we just didn't pay attention. We lost touch.
Yeah, it's the microbiology that's so powerful, and I think of regenerative farming and our kind of own human ecology and biomes in a very similar way, and you're starting to learn that the balance of fungus and bacteria are what dictate the fertility and the exchange of nutrients and sugars and all of these things. And so you're seeing how the human biome affects mental health and affects our overall health. And it's really coming down to the bacteria and the fungus and the balance of the two and the symbiosis. And I'm just blown away by the way all of these concepts connect and lead us back to regenerative farming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, like I said, with William Brown's work, getting into the metamorphic field and taking that, not I don't know, mycelium network, but the network of the universe energy system is like, oh my God, these guys are just like, man, this is incredible what they're doing, these geniuses, and what we're going to see between healing the earth and then tying into that energy field and using it, you know, to make food more effectively grown and to get energy for free and to heal ourselves. I mean, and we could have always had it.
Sure.
I mean, I'll tell you, these ET friends of ours, they know that. That's how they get across the universe. They're right. Tying right into that network. And we just decided to go in the way of oil and phosphorus, or not oil, but just phosphorus, but all oil. Sad. We never had to use oil.
No.
Yeah, learning from your mistakes is something that we all learn to do as we evolve. And as an industry, as people, I think we're doing that. And I hope we continue to.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, we are. We're going to lead the way across the board with regenerative farming, with food, with the, you know, getting these traditional farmers to clean their act up, alternative psychedelics, just everything. You know, we're powering it now. It's off, you know, off the charts.
Yeah, I do want to add in there, just on the spirit of the web in this circle of cannabis growers and the Emerald Triangle, as well as the synchronicities of life, the Celestine prophecy we mentioned earlier. You know, if we hadn't moved earlier and been standing on this other side of the property, we wouldn't have noticed this gentleman that drove down the road who was broke down.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to get a quick glimpse of his white dreadlocks.
I got you, unmistakable.
Yeah, and instantly, you know, I did the Celestine prophecy move. We were like, oh, that couldn't be him. And then you can say, oh no, you have to go over there and find out for sure. Because otherwise it's in the back of your head.
Totally.
And sure enough, of course it's him. You know, so I just walked up to him and it was awesome. I haven't seen that guy in 15 years. I quickly brought up, you know, him giving us a ride into Laguna Seca back in the early 90s. Because we needed a car to get through the gates. You couldn't just walk in for whatever reason. Maybe it was just the entrance we were trying to get into. But yeah, he let us hop into the back seat of his car, and there was, you know, a few pounds sitting on the back seat, which when you're 19 years old, 20 years old, I thought that was amazing, that there was just, you know, it was probably the most weed I think I'd ever seen all in one shot to begin with. But then the fact that we're just driving into a festival, and it was just like, oh yeah, no, this is going to be a great weekend. I remember being like, wow, this guy is amazing. And I've run into him very, you know, randomly over the years, but it has been a long time, at least a decade and a half.
You know, that synchronicity, you realize, I mean, it gets so instant that you become Sai Baba and you're materializing fruit for kids or candies. And so it's really just how clear your mind is, your higher self is connected. There was a gentleman who's a leading yoga teacher in the United States, Donald Schnell. He became Prima Baba Swamiji. He wrote a book called Initiation. And I was standing out in front, and he talked about synchronicity. He went over there after all these years to be initiated in the Swami order. And he ended up being told by his guru to go on like a 5-week journey and not stay in any place more than a couple of days. Well, these taxi cab drivers ended up taking him to other places, and he couldn't figure out what was going on. And he ended up at the foot of Babaji, who's the revered eternal saint of India. Supposedly he works with Christ hand in hand to shepherd this planet into to the new spiritual age. And his lineage is Lahina Mahasa, and then it was Yukastrar, and then it's Yogananda. So it's a direct lineage they brought Kriya Yoga in. And this guy was initiated by them. So he was initiated, and he was told by Babaji that he was doing this because this time in the West was coming. And so he wrote this book called Initiation about it, and he stopped in front of Area 101. I was out there sweeping, and he came up and looked and listened to what I was talking about, with all religions coming together in peace and harmony, and came back and prayed to the statues, and then ran out and got his book and signed it and said, I understand. And Babaji in that book told him that there were going to be sanctuaries along the West Coast that were going to start bringing in the idea of all religions coming together, recognizing the one God. And he said, you know, I've been looking up and down the West Coast, and yours is the first place I've seen that fit Babaji's description. And I'm just finishing that, writing that story up in the book before the Second Emerald Cup, because it was right before the Second Emerald Cup. And so I just wrote to them, because I haven't talked to them in almost 20 years.
But this place, it draws in so many random synchronicities, like that story. Because didn't you say that he talked about him on the first...
We brought up the Laytonville gas station, and this was the last place I ran into him. And we talked about just how epic and iconic that gas station is in the Emerald Triangle.
Mm-hmm. And I talked about my experience at that Laytonville gas station. That was the same person that approached me when I moved to Humboldt. The very first day we entered Northern California and stopped at the Laytonville gas station to fill up on gas for the home stretching. And this is the guy that walked up to me. So the synchronicity of him walking up at this moment goes beyond comprehension.
Well, what's even funnier is that naturally I walk up to him, and approaching anybody in this county with a history like him or any of us might.
Yeah.
He definitely froze in his tracks. So I quickly had to, explain to him what we were doing here.
That's a funny story.
And he actually told me he just got an invite from Chris Robinson to do a podcast that he is doing.
Wow.
Where he's going to be telling the stories of his experience in these hills.
Christopher Robbins?
Chris Robinson from the Black Crows.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris Robbins. Okay.
Yeah.
I got another.
Like serendipity all over.
Well, with any luck, a few episodes down the road, we're going to get him on here too, because this is the sort of thing that drives us forward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That.
Well, it's amazing to hear your backgrounds and where you come from, because you're obviously very evolved and spiritually awake and open. And so it's really cool to see that.
I was fortunate enough to land at a place, Black Bear Ranch. It's an intentional community that was started in the 60s in the Back to Nature movement, Back to the Land, right out of the Digger family in San Francisco. So I was, right into it, didn't have a choice. 20 years, all of the bad habits and wrong teachings of growing up in Manhattan and in the Bronx and... a single mom who was constantly gone, a dad who got caught up in the drug war and was, pretty much looking at 25 to life and jumped. I didn't know my dad until I was 26. So I jumped into this intentional community where there were just a huge, just the presence of males in my life that were amazing, spiritual, knew how to be good dads and big community members. And I was, the blessings of just following them around and learning about picking mushrooms and cutting down my own firewood and washing cloth diapers for my newborn baby and things like that. So, yeah, it was just a night and day, apples to oranges, from one coast to the other. And it's something I always say to this day, that I was born there, not really in New York City, because the person I am today was born pretty much in that little valley up on the Salmon River.
That's cool. That's a great story. Again, how fate brings you to those people and those interactions and those teachers.
Yeah.
And those places. Uh-huh. And that's another important thing. I know you were on a Clubhouse chat room the other day, and I was listening in with Leilana on Humboldt Grace.
Oh, that was a different one, yeah.
Yeah, and that was a different one the day before, but we talked about what made Northern California weed so special, and I really think it's place, and it's very energetic microcosms and vortexes, and I feel like Black Bear is one of those places. Over and over and over, as I've gone through life, I've never been there, but you hear about all of these people who have connected through that place, and I run into them over and over and over, and it comes out really quickly that you're connected to that place. And same thing with this place here, and I know our producer has a ton of history. Emmanuel's been coming down to the ranch for years, just connecting with the people and the spirituality, and I really think that these energy vortexes are a big part of this change?
Well, California as a whole, if you look at Native Americans, look at it, you had warlike tribes all throughout the country. Then you get over here to California and it's like, these people are partying. They're having a great time. they're not going for that. They're just like living a different way. And we just followed right into that energy, the whole vortex of this place. And it's really like the heart chakra of the world now. It used to be England, they say, but now it's really here. And we're all drawn to that for these reasons. That's why you look at all the technology. You look at all the spirituality going on here. You look at all the new ways of thinking, evolving, and it's all here. And that's why.
And it's crazy even with the cannabis industry, because when I travel, I went to Barcelona for the first time, and it's crazy how I didn't realize that, like, literally everybody kind of has their eyes on what California is doing, and like kind of that's where the trends come out of, that's where the brands come out of. I went to a club in Barcelona, it's called La Colada, and they had this Emerald Cup blanket up on the wall, and I was like, what is that? You know, like, you just see it and you're like, wow, because you don't want to seem pretentious, but you're like, oh wow, people really are like looking at what California does in the industry and kind of taking like our lead. So
they don't always want to admit it.
Yeah, exactly. They might not admit
that too,
it,
but yeah.
No, they do. You look at genetics, you look at everything here. We lead the way. We're guiding them.
Yeah.
Although, you know what, there's so many OG farmers and product makers that have moved out, though, yeah, into Salinas, Santa Barbara.
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma. Yeah. Oklahoma is amazing what's going on.
Absolutely.
There. You know, and they're going to take all that knowledge there, and that's good. That's good. They'll learn from what they, you know, got here, and they'll take it there and do better.
I look at Oklahoma very similarly to how I look at the farm in Tennessee. When you take, a huge conglomeration of energy and knowledge and this beautiful plant, and you drop it right in the middle of a place like Oklahoma, it's very similar to how the farm commune, they picked that property, they built a city in the middle of something that was completely, you know, different than the mindset of that caravan that left San Francisco with that goal in mind. And it has changed the consciousness, you know. Woodstock in upstate New York, that happening there, it changed the consciousness. There's a ripple effect that's just, it's going to happen no matter what. And I think that's what's happening in Oklahoma.
You know what?
Misery next.
Who would have ever thought that Oklahoma, you know, and I hear all the Bulgarians and the Hmongs and everybody are moving out there because it's easier to ship and stuff. And this, you know, Patrick King and Daniel from Anastasi, all the business they're doing out there. And it's just like, imagine these redneck Christian white dudes, and all of a sudden you got the Bulgarians, and you got the Hmongs and the Hispanics, and they're just like, what is going on? And within 5 years, they're going to be outnumbered, and, you know, all the laws will change, and organic food stores will jump up, and it'll be like, you know, affect it.
Get ready. It's an awakening.
It is an awakening. That's what it is. A mass consciousness awakening.
We've had people tell us, oh, you know, you guys are telling all these Humboldt stories. You're focusing on California. Like, you don't want to sound pretentious. And I came from Michigan. This is not my place. This isn't my story. It's our story. And it's a story of place. And recognizing that it is the energy that is moving through the entire country. And it's attracting this other like group of people that want to take this energy out. And that's one of the most special things about what we get to do on the podcast. And I'm going to take this moment to say thank you all so much for letting us come and share your space and share your stories and share our stories with you. And just, this is what cannabis is about to me, this connection to people, connection to place, and growing our community. And that's why we call this Royal Grown Radio, because we're trying to grow together as a community to elevate. So I just really thank you so much for having us.
No doubt.
Today.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you inviting us. This was a beautiful afternoon. We got to sit outside, even though the logging experience was going on mid conversation. It was still lovely to sit outside and just have a conversation with you guys.
And very Northern California have a little bit of logging going on behind us. So, you know, wow. That was a deep dive through an entire world of information. And, you know, I say we typically take a short break
for hours
in these sessions and just take a minute, get a drink of water, maybe enjoy some medicine and come back to talk. So I think this is a perfect breaking point as we all just stood here dumbfounded by this exchange of information.
And like the chainsaw, I was like, it's every noise now. Then it was like a chainsaw. Then it was like a grinding thing. And like, oh no, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, they've really stepped it up. They're really doing their best to like, are you like, getting the sound okay? We'll see.
It sounds psychedelic. It sounds like a Pink Floyd song.
Oh my, perfect.
That's a little bit of that beep.
That's awesome.
I think this is also a good moment to give a shout out to our producer, Emmanuel Nemethy, and all the work he does behind the scenes. We'll see what it makes it to your ears at home, but right now there's a crazy logging operation that it feels like it's right in front of us, and we'll see if it makes it to you at home, but if it doesn't, you have Emmanuel to thank.
Yes.
Yeah, he's back there looking at it like, okay, we're going to see it.